Hello, and welcome to the Pediatric Critical Care Medicine Audio Abstracts. I'm Dr. Erin Bennett, and on behalf of PCCM, I'm happy to present this audio recording of the research abstracts that appear in this month's issue. Let's get started. Abstract 1 is a feature article by Kloek et al. The Association of Corticosteroids in Pediatric Sepsis Biomarker Risk Model, PERSEVERE 2, Biomarker Risk Stratification with Mortality in Pediatric Septic Shock. Objectives. Mortality risk stratification may identify a subset of children who benefit from or are harmed by corticosteroid administration. The Pediatric Sepsis Biomarker Risk Model, or PERSEVERE 2 score, is a biomarker-based mortality risk stratification tool for pediatric sepsis. Our objective was to assess the association of corticosteroid administration with 28-day mortality within different levels of baseline mortality risk, or PERSEVERE 2, in a cohort of children with septic shock. Design. We performed a secondary analysis using prospectively collected data from January 2015 to December 2018. Setting: PICUs in 13 tertiary care academic centers in the United States. Patients: children with septic shock. There were no interventions. Measurements and main results. We assessed the association of corticosteroid administration within PERSEVERE 2 risk score categories and 28-day mortality, ICU-free days, and maximum failed organs in children with septic shock. We analyzed a total of 461 patients, including 215 with corticosteroid exposure and 246 without corticosteroid exposure, with an average age of 7.1 years old and an interquartile range of 2.2 to 13.6 years old. In the subgroup of patients with a high PERSEVERE 2 score, corticosteroid administration was associated with an increased adjusted risk of 28-day mortality, with an odds ratio of 4.1, a 95% confidence interval of 1.7 to 9.86, and a p-value equal to 0.002, but not in the low-risk group, with an odds ratio of 0.2, a 95% confidence interval of 0.02 to 1.73, and a p-value equal to 0.15. A significant interaction between PERSEVERE 2 score and corticosteroids was seen for both secondary outcomes complicated course with a p-value equal to 0.01 and maximum failed organs with a p-value less than 0.001. Corticosteroid exposure was associated with fewer ICU-free days with a p-value less than 0.0001. Conclusions. In our multicenter observational study, corticosteroid administration was associated with increased mortality in a subgroup of children with high PERSEVERE 2 risk score. Abstract 2 is a feature article by Brown et al. The relationship between postoperative complications and children's quality of life, a mediation analysis to explore the role of family factors. Objectives: to explore whether postoperative morbidities after pediatric cardiac surgery affected children's health-related quality of life at 6 months through potentially modifiable parental psychological factors. Design. We undertook a mediation analysis to explore the causal pathway based on data from a prospective case-matched cohort study. Patients: 666 children undergoing cardiac surgery. Setting: 5 centers in the United Kingdom. There were no interventions. Measurements and main results. Cases of morbidity were identified early after pediatric cardiac surgery, and matched controls with no morbidities were identified at discharge. 4 mediators were assessed at 6 weeks after surgery using the PEDS-QL Family Impact Module, which assessed parent health-related quality of life and family function, and the PHQ-4, which assessed anxiety and depression. The study outcome of child health-related quality of life was assessed at 6 months with the PEDS-QL. Of 666 children, 408, or 65% of those surviving, contributed to the primary outcome. Children who had extracorporeal life support and multiple morbidities had worse 6-month health-related quality of life than those with a single morbidity or no morbidity. 11 children had extracorporeal life support with a p-value less than 0.05. 62 children had multiple morbidities with a p-value less than 0.01. 125 children had a single morbidity, and 209 children had no morbidity. After adjustment for case mix complexity and sociodemographic variables, there were significant indirect effects of parent health-related quality of life at 6 weeks on the PEDS-QL total score. The PEDS-QL total score for extracorporeal life support was negative 5.1, with an interquartile range of negative 8.4 to negative 1.8, and a p-value equal to 0.003. and the PEDS-QL total score for multiple morbidities was negative 2.1 with an interquartile range of negative 3.7 to negative 0.5 with a p-value equal to 0.01. The PEDS-QL physical score for extracorporeal life support was negative 5.1 with an interquartile range of negative 8.7 to negative 1.4 and a p-value equal to 0.007. And the PEDS-QL physical score for multiple morbidities was negative 2.1 with an interquartile range of negative 3.8 to negative 0.4 with a p-value equal to 0.016. The PEDS-QL psychosocial score for extracorporeal life support was negative 5.3 with an interquartile range of negative 8.7 to negative 1.8 and a p-value equal to 0.003. And the PEDS-QL psychosocial score for multiple morbidities was negative 2.2 with an interquartile range of negative 3.9 to negative 0.5 and a p-value equal to 0.01. The proportion of the total effect of extracorporeal life support and multiple morbidity on the study outcomes mediated through parent health-related quality of life ranges between 18% and 61%. There was no evidence that the other three mediators had indirect effects on the study outcome. Conclusions. Parental health-related quality of life at 6 weeks after surgery contributes to child health-related quality of life at 6 months among those with the severest types of morbidity and as such should be a target for future interventions. Abstract 3 is a feature article by Eliopoulos et al. Absolute versus relative near-infrared spectroscopy in pediatric cardiac patients. Objectives. Near-infrared spectroscopy, or NIRS, has been increasingly accepted as a non-invasive marker of regional tissue oxygenation despite concerns of imprecision and wide limits of agreement with invasive oximetry. New generation absolute monitors may have improved accuracy compared with trend monitors. We sought to compare the concordance with invasive venous oximetry of a new generation absolute NIRS oximeter, the Foresight Elite by Casmid in Branford, Connecticut, with a modern widely used trend monitor, the Infos 5100C by Medtronic in Minneapolis, Minnesota. Design, prospective single-center study. Setting, tertiary pediatric heart center. Patients, children undergoing elective cardiac catheterization under general anesthesia. Time-paired jugular and renal venous oximetry samples were compared with NIRS-derived oximetry by two monitors using regression and Bland-Altman analysis. There were no interventions. Measurements and main results. We enrolled 36 children, including 19 female and 10 cyanotic, with a median age of 4.1 years and an interquartile range of 2.5 to 7.8 years, and weight of 16.7 kilograms with an interquartile range of 12.3 to 29.1 kilograms. The absolute difference between NIRS-derived and invasive jugular oximetry was less than 10% in 67% of occasions for both monitors. Correlation was fair for the Foresight Elite and poor for the Invos 5100C. The Spearman R sub S for the Foresight Elite was equal to 0.4 with a p-value less than 0.001. And the Spearman R sub S for the Invos 5100C was equal to 0.06 with a p-value equal to 0.45. Bias for the Foresight Elite was positive 6.7% with limits of agreement positive 22% to negative 9%, while bias for the Invos 5100C was 1.3% with limits of agreement positive 24% to negative 21%. The absolute difference between NIRS-derived and invasive renal oximetry was less than 10% in 80% of occasions with moderate correlation, with an R sub S equal to 0.57 and a p-value less than 0.001 for the Foresight Elite, and in 61% of occasions with moderate correlation with an R sub S equal to 0.58 and a p-value less than 0.001 for the Invos 5100C. Bias for the Foresight Elite was positive 3.6% with limits of agreement positive 19% to negative 12%, and bias for the Invos 5100C was negative 1.4% with limits of agreement positive 27% to negative 30%. NIRS correlation with renal venous oximetry was worse for cyanotic versus non-cyanotic patients with a p-value equal to 0.02. In conclusion, concordance and limits of agreement of NIRS-derived oximetry with invasive venous oximetry in the cerebral and renal vascular beds was suboptimal for clinical decision-making. Cyanosis adversely affected NIRS performance in the renal site. Abstract 4 is a clinical investigation by Fernandez Sarmiento et al. Endothelial and glycocalyx biomarkers in children with sepsis after one bolus of unbalanced or balanced crystalloids. Objectives. To assess the disruption of endothelial glycocalyx integrity in children with sepsis receiving fluid resuscitation with either balanced or unbalanced crystalloids.
The primary outcome was endothelial glycocalyx disruption using perfused boundary region over 2 micrometers on sublingual video microscopy and syndicin 1 greater than 80 milligrams per deciliter according to the type of crystalloid. The secondary outcomes were increased vascular permeability using angiopoietin 2 level, apoptosis using annexin A5 level, and associated clinical changes. Design: a single-center prospective cohort study from January to December 2021. Setting: 12 medical surgical PICU beds at a university hospital. Patients: children with sepsis or septic shock before and after receiving fluid resuscitation with crystalloids for hemodynamic instability. There were no interventions. Measurements and main results. We included 106 patients with a median of 3.9 years and an interquartile range of 0.6 to 13.1 years. 58 of 106, or 55%, received boluses of unbalanced crystalloid. This group had greater odds of endothelial glycocalyx degradation, 84.5% versus 60.4%, adjusted odds ratio 3.78, 95% confidence interval 1.49 to 9.58, and a p-value less than 0.1 6 hours after fluid administration, which correlated with increased angiopoietin 2, with a rho equal to 0.4 and a p-value less than 0.05, and elevated annexin A5, with a p-value equal to 0.04. This group also had greater odds of metabolic acidosis associated with elevated syndicin 1 and acute kidney injury associated with endothelial glycocalyx damage. The odds ratio for syndicin 1 was 4.88 with a 95% confidence interval of 1.23 to 28.08, and the odds ratio for acute kidney injury was 1.7 with a 95% confidence interval of 1.12 to 3.18. The perfused boundary region returned to baseline 24 hours after receiving the crystalloid boluses. In conclusion, children with sepsis, particularly those who receive unbalanced crystalloid solutions during resuscitation, show loss and worsening of endothelial glycocalyx. The abnormality peaks at around 6 hours after fluid administration and is associated with greater odds of metabolic acidosis and acute kidney injury. Abstract 5 is a clinical investigation by Olszewski et al. Risk factors for positive post-traumatic stress disorder screening and associated outcomes in children surviving acute respiratory failure, a secondary analysis of the randomized evaluation of sedation titration for respiratory failure clinical trial. Objectives: to identify risk factors and outcomes associated with a positive post-traumatic stress disorder or PTSD screen following pediatric acute respiratory failure treated with invasive mechanical ventilation. Design: non-pre-specified secondary analysis of a randomized clinical trial. Setting: 31 U.S. PICUs. Patients: children in the randomized evaluation of sedation titration for respiratory failure or RESTORE trial over 8 years old who completed PTSD screening 6 months after discharge. Interventions: RESTORE sites were randomized to a targeted, nurse-directed sedation strategy versus usual care. Measurements and main results: PTSD screening was completed by 102 subjects using the Child Post-Traumatic Stress Disorder Symptom Scale. A score of greater than or equal to 11 was considered screening positive for PTSD. Cognitive status was categorized using Pediatric Cerebral Performance Category. Health-related quality of life was evaluated using Child-Reported Pediatric Quality of Life Inventory version 4.0. 31 children, or 30%, screened positive for PTSD. Children with a positive screen endorsed symptoms in all categories: re-experiencing, avoidance, and hyperarousal. Most endorsed that symptoms interfered with schoolwork with an N equal to 18 or 58%, and happiness with an N equal to 17 or 55%. Screening positive was not associated with RESTORE treatment group. In a multivariable logistic model adjusting for age, sex, and treatment group, screening positive was independently associated with lower median income in the family's residential zip code, renal dysfunction, and clinically significant pain in the PICU. Median income was compared with income greater than or equal to $80,000. Income less than $40,000 had an odds ratio of 32.8 with a 95% confidence interval of 2.3 to 458.1. And $40,000 to $79,999 had an odds ratio of 15.6 with a 95% confidence interval of 1.3 to 182.8. Renal dysfunction had an odds ratio of 5.3 with a 95% confidence interval of 1.7 to 16.7. and clinically significant pain in the PICU had an odds ratio of 8.3 with a 95% confidence interval of 1.9 to 35.7. Children with a positive screen experienced decline in cognitive function and impaired health-related quality of life more frequently than children with a negative screen. In conclusion, screening positive for PTSD is common among children following acute respiratory failure and is associated with lower health-related quality of life and decline in cognitive function. Routine PTSD screening may be warranted to optimize recovery. Abstract 6 is a clinical investigation by Mao et al. Improving outcomes for bronchiolitis patients after implementing a high-flow nasal cannula holiday and standardizing discharge criteria in a PICU. Objectives: to decrease length of high-flow nasal cannula, PICU length of stay, and hospital length of stay. Design: a quality improvement project. Setting: a quaternary academic PICU. Patients included: patients with bronchiolitis less than 24 months old. Interventions: after initial implementation of a respiratory therapist or RT-driven high-flow nasal cannula protocol with a Plan Do Study Act or PDSA-1 in October 2017, additional interventions included adjusting high-flow nasal cannula wean rate, which was PDSA-2 in July 2020, a high-flow nasal cannula holiday, which was PDSA-3, and standardizing discharge criteria, which was PDSA-4 in October 2021. Measurements and main results. Duration of high-flow nasal cannula was used as the primary outcome measure. PICU length of stay and hospital length of stay were used as secondary outcome measures. Non-invasive ventilation use, invasive mechanical ventilation use, and 7-day PICU and hospital readmission rates were used as balancing measures. A total of 1,310 patients were included in this study. Patients in PDSA-2, PDSA-3, and PDSA-4 groups were older compared with pre-intervention and PDSA-1, with a median of 9 and 10 months compared with 8 months, p-value equal to 0.01. High-flow nasal cannula duration decreased from 2.5 to 1.8 days after PDSA-1, then to 1.3 days after PDSA-2. PICU length of stay decreased from 2.6 to 2.1 days after PDSA-1, 1.8 days after PDSA-2, and 1.5 days after PDSA-3 and 4. Hospital length of stay decreased from 5.7 to 4.5 days after PDSA-1, 3.1 days after PDSA-2, and 2.7 days after PDSA-3 and 4. The use of non-invasive ventilation and invasive mechanical ventilation decreased throughout the study from 23.2% in the pre-intervention group to 6.9% at the end of the project. The 7-day PICU and hospital readmission rates did not increase after implementation. The percentage of patients discharged from the PICU increased from 6.2% to 21.5%. In conclusion, modifications to an existing RT-driven high-flow nasal cannula protocol and standardization of discharge criteria led to an improved outcome in patients admitted to the PICU with bronchiolitis without an increase in adverse events. Abstract 7 is a brief report by Hatch et al. Trends in neonatal extracorporeal membrane oxygenation during a veno-venous cannula shortage. Objectives: to report temporal trends in veno-venous extracorporeal membrane oxygenation, or ECMO, use for neonatal respiratory failure in U.S. centers before and after functional veno-venous cannula shortage due to withdrawal of one dual-lumen veno-venous cannula from the market in 2018. The design was a retrospective cohort study. Setting: ECMO Registry of the Extracorporeal Life Support Organization. Patients included infants who received neonatal respiratory ECMO who were cannulated prior to 29 days of age at a U.S. center and had a record available in the ECMO registry from January 1, 2010 to July 20, 2021. There were no interventions. Measurements and main results. Primary outcome was receipt of veno-venous ECMO versus veno-arterial or other, and secondary outcomes were survival to hospital discharge and adverse neurologic outcomes. Using an interrupted time series design, we fit multivariable mixed effects logistic regression models with receipt of veno-venous ECMO as the dependent variable, treatment year modeled as a piecewise linear variable using three linear splines, pre-shortage 2010 to 2014, 2014 to 2018, and shortage 2018 to 2021, and adjusted for center clustering and multiple covariates. We evaluated trends in veno-venous ECMO use by primary diagnosis, including congenital diaphragmatic hernia, meconium aspiration, pulmonary hypertension, and other. annual neonatal veno-venous ECMO rates decreased after 2018. From 2010 to 2014, the adjusted odds ratio for yearly trend was 0.98, with a 95% confidence interval of 0.92 to 1.04. From 2014 to 2018, the adjusted odds ratio for yearly trend was 0.9, with a 95% confidence interval of 0.8 to 1.01, and after 2018, the adjusted odds ratio for yearly trend was 0.46, with a 95% confidence interval of 0.37 to 0.57. We identified decreased veno-venous ECMO use after 2018 in all diagnoses evaluated, and we failed to identify differences in temporal trends between diagnoses. Survival and adverse neurologic outcomes were unchanged across the study periods. In conclusion, veno-venous ECMO for neonatal respiratory failure in U.S. centers decreased after 2018, even after accounting for temporal trends, coincident with withdrawal of one of two veno-venous cannulas from the market. Abstract 8 is an online clinical investigation by Shiri et al. Sustained low-efficiency dialysis in critically ill children with acute kidney injury, single-center observational cohort in a resource-limited setting. Objectives: to evaluate the use of sustained low-efficiency dialysis, or SLED, in critically ill children with acute kidney injury in a resource-limited setting. Design: observational database cohort study from December 2016 to January 2020. Setting: PICU of a tertiary hospital in India. Patients: critically ill children undergoing SLED were included in the study. There were no interventions. Measurements and main results: demographic and clinical data, prescription variables, hemodynamic status, complications, kidney, and patient outcomes of all children undergoing SLED in the PICU were analyzed. A total of 33 children received 103 sessions of SLED. The median age of children who received SLED were 9 years, with an intraquartile range of 4.5 to 12.8 years, and weight was 26 kilograms, with an intraquartile range of 15.2 to 34 kilograms. The most common diagnosis was sepsis with septic shock in 17 patients, and the mean pediatric risk of mortality 3 score at admission was 11.8, with a standard deviation plus or minus 6.4. The median number and mean duration of inotropes per session were 3 hours with an interquartile range of 2 to 4 hours and 96 hours plus or minus the standard deviation of 82 hours, respectively. Of 103 sessions, the most common indication for SLED was oliguria with fluid overload and the need for creating space for fluid and nutritional support in 45 sessions, or 44%. The mean duration of SLED was 6.4 hours with a standard deviation plus or minus 1.3 hours, with 72 of 103 sessions requiring priming. The mean ultrafiltration rate per session achieved was 4.6 with a standard deviation of plus or minus 3 milliliters per kilogram per hour. There was significant decrease in urea and creatinine by the end of SLED compared with the start, with a mean change in urea being 32.36 milligrams per deciliter with a 95% confidence interval of 18.53 to 46.18 milligrams per deciliter with a p-value less than 0.001, and a change in serum creatinine by 0.7 milligrams per deciliter with a 95% confidence interval of 0.35 to 1.06 milligrams per deciliter and a p-value less than 0.001. Complications were observed in 44 of 103 sessions, most common being intradialytic hypotension in 21 of 103 and bleeding at the catheter site in 21 of 103. Despite complications in one-third of the sessions, only 9 sessions were prematurely stopped, and 23 of 33 patients receiving SLED survived. Conclusions: in critically ill children, our experience with SLED is that it is feasible and provides a viable form of kidney replacement therapy in a resource-limited setting. Abstract 9 is an online clinical investigation by Titus et al. Adolescent drug ingestions requiring ICU stay, single-center retrospective cohort study. Objectives: ingestions are a prevalent form of self-harm in teenagers and are unfortunately an increasingly common reason for admission to both acute care and critical care services. The goal of this study was to identify characteristics associated with requiring PICU stay among adolescents hospitalized for ingestions. Design: retrospective cohort study comparing patients admitted to hospital medicine service and critical care service from January 2019 to December 2019. Setting, freestanding children's hospital in the Midwestern United States. Patients, adolescents 12 to 18 years old hospitalized for ingestion. There were no interventions. Measurements and main results. Out of 209 patients included in the study cohort, 95 required PICU admission. High-risk behaviors, including having had sex or usage of alcohol, drugs, tobacco, or vaping, were endorsed by 190 of 209 patients, or 91%. We compared patient characteristics, ingestion history, workup, and pharmacological and PICU-specific interventions between patients hospitalized on the hospital medicine service and the PICU. We failed to identify an association between reason for ingestion, substance ingested, and previously identified suicide risk factors, including previous suicide attempt, previous self-harm, and psychiatric comorbidity and admission to the PICU, as opposed to non-PICU admission. PICU stay was associated with longer peak corrected QT interval value, receiving a pharmacologic intervention, and longer duration of hospital stay. 15 of 95 patients, or 16%, with a 95% confidence interval of 9 to 25% in the PICU received a PICU-specific intervention. In conclusion, we failed to identify specific patient demographics or mental behavioral health characteristics associated with PICU stay after ingestion. Therefore, we believe that all adolescents hospitalized due to ingestion, irrespective of disposition, should receive standardized high-risk behavior screening due to the pervasive nature of these behaviors among this patient population. PICU-specific care beyond observation could be needed in as high as 1 in 4 PICU admissions. Further research is needed to inform optimal disposition and resource allocation for this patient population. Abstract 10 is an online clinical investigation by Jones et al. Randomization to a liberal versus conservative oxygenation target, redox responses in critically ill children. Rationale: optimal systemic oxygenation targets in pediatric critical illness are unknown. A U-shaped relationship exists between blood oxygen levels and PICU mortality. Redox stress or iatrogenic injury from intensive treatments are potential mechanisms of harm from hyperoxia. Objectives: to measure biomarkers of oxidative stress in children admitted to PICU and randomized to conservative versus liberal peripheral oxygenation targets. Conservative targets were oxygen hemoglobin saturation, or SpO2, of 88 to 92%, whereas liberal targets were SpO2 greater than 94%. Design: mechanistic sub-study nested within the oxygen in PICU or oxy-PICU pilot randomized feasibility clinical trial. Setting: 3 UK mixed medical and surgical PICUs in university hospitals. Patients: 75 eligible patients randomized to the oxy-PICU randomized feasibility clinical trial. Interventions: randomization to a conservative versus liberal peripheral oxygenation target. Conservative SpO2 target was 88 to 92%, and a liberal SpO2 target was greater than 94%. Measurements and main results: blood and urine samples were collected at two time points, less than 24 hours and up to 72 hours from randomization in trial participants, from March 2017 to July 2017. Plasma was analyzed for markers of ischemic and oxidative response, namely thiobarbituric acid reactive substances, or TBARS, a lipid peroxidation marker, and ischemia-modified albumin, a protein oxidation marker. Total urinary nitrate and nitrite were measured as a marker of reactive oxygen and nitrogen species. Blood hypoxia-inducible factor, or HIF-1A messenger RNA expression, or hypoxia response gene, was measured by reverse transcription polymerase chain reaction. Total urinary nitrate and nitrite levels were greater in the liberal compared with conservative oxygenation group at 72 hours, with a median difference 32.6 micromoles per millimoles of creatinine and a 95% confidence interval of 13.7 to 93.6 with a p-value less than 0.002 in the Mann-Whitney test. HIF-1A messenger RNA expression was increased sixfold in the conservative group compared with the liberal group in less than 24-hour samples, with a 95% confidence interval 1.3 to 24, with a p-value equal to 0.032. There were no significant differences in thiobarbituric acid reactive substances or ischemia-modified albumin. In conclusion, On comparing liberal with conservative oxygenation targets, we show, first, significant redox response with an increase in urinary markers of reactive oxygen and nitrogen species, but no changes in markers of lipid or protein oxygenation. We also show what appears to be an early hypoxic response with an increase in HIF-1A gene expression in subjects exposed to conservative rather than liberal oxygenation targets. Abstract 11 is an online cardiac intensive care article by Cleveland et al. Inter-rater reliability of delirium screening of infants in the cardiac ICU, a prospective observational study. Objectives: to determine the inter-rater reliability of the Cornell Assessment for Pediatric Delirium, or CAPD, in infants admitted to a cardiac ICU or CVICU, and to explore the impact of younger age and mechanical ventilation on inter-rater reliability. Design: a prospective cross-sectional study of delirium screening performed by bedside CVICU nurses. We collected data from September 2020 to April 2021. We evaluated inter-rater reliability with intra-class correlation coefficient, one-way random effects, and FICE-Kappa for multiple raters. Setting: 18-bed academic pediatric CVICU. Participants: subjects included infants 1 day to 1 year old admitted to the CVICU stratified in two age groups, less than or equal to 9 weeks old and 9 weeks old to less than 1 year old. Exclusion criteria were patients' immediate postoperative day, state behavioral scale score less than or equal to -2, or at risk for hemodynamic instability with assessment. Raters included CVICU nurses working in the unit during study days. There were no interventions. Measurements and main results. Groups of four raters performed 91 assessments, a total of 364 CAPD screens. 45 of 91, or 49%, were in patients less than or equal to 9 weeks old, and 43 of 91, or 47%, in mechanically ventilated patients. 68 of 81 nurses, or 81%, participated. In infants less than or equal to 9 weeks old, intra-class correlation coefficient was 0.59, with a 95% confidence interval of 0.44 to 0.71, with poor to moderate reliability, which was significantly lower than the intra-class correlation coefficient in infants greater than 9 weeks old of 0.72, with a 95% confidence interval of 0.61 to 0.82, with moderate to good reliability. In mechanically ventilated infants, intra-class correlation coefficient was 0.5, with a 95% confidence interval of 0.34 to 0.65, with poor to moderate reliability, which was significantly lower than the intra-class correlation coefficient in non-mechanically ventilated infants, which was 0.69, with a 95% confidence interval of 0.57 to 0.8, and moderate to good reliability. FICE-Kappa for all infants was 0.47 with a 95% confidence interval of 0.34 to 0.6 with slight to fair agreement. Use of anchor points did not improve reliability. Conclusions: in the youngest, most vulnerable infants admitted to the CVICU, further evaluation of the CAPD tool is needed. Abstract 12 is an online brief report by Nickerson et al. Organ dysfunction among children meeting brain death criteria. Implications for organ donation. Objectives: over 70% of pediatric organ donors are declared deceased by brain death criteria. Patients with these devastating neurologic injuries often have accompanying multiple organ dysfunction. This study was performed to characterize organ dysfunction in children who met brain death criteria and were able to donate their organs compared with those deemed medically ineligible. Design: retrospective cohort study. Setting: PICU at a quaternary care children's hospital. Patients: patients with International Classification of Diseases 9th edition codes corresponding to brain death between 2012 and 2018 were included. Measurements and main results: demographics, comorbidities, pediatric risk of mortality 3 score, and injury mechanisms were derived from the medical record. Organ dysfunction was quantified by evaluating peak daily organ-specific variables. 58 patients from newborn to 22 years old were included with a median pediatric risk of mortality 3 score of 34 with an interquartile range of 26 to 36, and all met criteria for multiple organ dysfunction syndrome. 34 of 58, or 59%, of children with brain death donated at least one organ. Of the donors, not mutually exclusive proportions, 10 of 34 donated lungs, with a peak oxygenation index of 11 and an interquartile range of 8 to 23. 24 to 34 donated their heart, with peak vasoactive inotrope scores of 23 and an interquartile range of 18 to 33. 31 of 34 donated kidneys, of whom 16 of 31, or 52%, had evidence of acute kidney injury, and 28 of 34 patients donated their liver, with peak alanine transferase, or ALT, of 104 units per liter, with an interquartile range of 44 to 268 units per liter, and aspartate aminotransferase, or AST, of 165 units per liter, with an interquartile range of 94 to 434 units per liter. Organ dysfunction was similar between heart and lung donors and respective medically ineligible non-donors. Those deemed medically ineligible to donate their liver had higher peak ALT of 1,518 units per liter with an interquartile range of 986 to 1,748 units per liter and a p-value equal to 0.01, and AST of 2,200 units per liter with an interquartile range of 1,453 to 2,405 units per liter and a p-value equal to 0.01 compared with liver donors. Conclusions. In our single-center experience, all children with brain death had multiple organ dysfunction syndrome, yet more than one half were still able to donate organs. Future research should further evaluate transplant outcomes of dysfunctional organs prior to standardizing donation eligibility criteria. The PCCM narrative this month is by Jillian Bybee, entitled The Trip of a Lifetime. Early in my career, I stood in our PICU manager's office, apologizing for something I'd done earlier that day. It wasn't only me who had participated, but as the attending of record in charge of the PICU team, I felt like the transgression was mine to own. Frankly, as a lifetime rule follower, I was still shocked by what I had done. Our team had taken an intubated patient and their family outside across the street where I had to block traffic for family photos prior to what would likely be a terminal extubation. Earlier in the day, I'd had no plans of an excursion like the one we took, or a concept that it was possible. I'd led family-centered rounds at my patient's room, talked to the family and consultants about our plan for extubation later that day, and validated the family's hope that my patient would survive to discharge so they could spend time at home with extended family. Then, I'd set about seeing my other patients and writing my notes in order to allow me to return later for the extubation. Unbeknownst to me, our experienced bedside nurse had been talking to my patient's family about their hopes and plans, uncovering more of their story than physicians like me are able to during the brief moments we flit in and out of our patients' rooms. In the late morning, she approached me with her idea. Take my patient and their family outside for pictures because they had never been able to take them before. Before truly understanding what was required, I happily replied yes, if we had the necessary team members. She told me that our respiratory therapist, nurse tech, and resident physician had already agreed, so we planned a time that worked for all of us. I arrived at the room just prior to our scheduled departure, asking where on the hospital patio we'd be going to take the photos. The reply I received from the patient's nurse was unexpected. "We are going to the park across the street. It's more private," she said. I hesitated and considered canceling, knowing the risks and potential policy violations involved in transporting an intubated patient across a street. However, the excitement radiating from my patient's parents and the team was palpable. So I proceeded, the risk-related hesitancy lingering within me. Prior to leaving, we discussed one point that had been overlooked prior to the trip. What if my patient extubates during the transport? Their code status was "do not resuscitate," which had been discussed in prior conversations. However, this seemed different. If my patient extubated while traveling, I would feel a heavy sense of responsibility if they died. I didn't know if I could live with it. "We don't want the breathing tube back in," the parents replied matter-of-factly, seeming more at ease with their decision than I was. I again considered deferring, but upon again observing the family's joy at the prospect of a photo session, I decided to keep my concerns to myself. Everyone else likely knew the risks, but they were more focused on the reward. We packed up to go, arranging the patient's mother in a wheelchair and the intubated patient in her arms, a blanket draped over them to give more privacy on our journey. The rest of the group hummed with energy as we set off through the hospital, navigating the elevator and hallways with relative ease. As we passed the onlookers in the building, we nonchalantly nodded and continued on our way. I can't imagine what everyone was thinking as we rolled through the emergency department and out the ambulance bay doors toward the street. To this day, I'm surprised no one said anything. Does everyone take it for granted that the PICU attending knows what she's doing? Any worry I had disappeared once we reached our destination. The team masterfully navigated the photo shoot, safely and carefully arranging my patient in such a way that you could not see that they were intubated. The sunlight streaming through the trees made for near-perfect lighting to capture all the love held in those family moments. I looked on, knowing that we would make it back to the PICU without a problem, but that I would have some explaining to do once we got there. It's okay, I thought. This was worth it. After our uneventful return, I headed to our PICU manager's office. Still caught up in the beauty of what I had witnessed, I relayed the story and offered my apologies for breaking a countless number of hospital policies. Her response took me by surprise. "I'm proud of you," she said, "and I'm also glad that you told me afterward so I didn't have to stop you." Ultimately, my patient was extubated later that day without complication, and they were subsequently discharged on hospice. I received word of their death a few days later through the palliative care team. I had expected the news, but did not expect the thanks to our team that accompanied it. The patient's parents, even in their grief, were so appreciative of the team's willingness to help them make memories before their child's death. Although this journey was years ago now, I can close my eyes and feel like I'm in the park again, watching the family bask in their moment of near normalcy. The other members of the team and I relive it often as one of the highlights of our careers, and I retell the tale often to illustrate how I learned that, when it comes to making memories and meaning for our patients and families, sometimes you must bend the rules a little bit. This concludes the abstracts for the March 2023 issue of Pediatric Critical Care Medicine. Thank you very much for listening. For more journal-related content, including access to the articles mentioned in this recording, please visit pccmjournal.org. Members of the SCCM Pediatric Section receive complimentary access to the PCCM Journal.